music from Bob Bennett. Carpenter Gone Bad, it's called. 11 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday morning, and we're delighted to welcome Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times into the studio, at least electronically. We have him here. Get to see each other's pictures, and you're looking very dapper. In fine fettle today, are you, Doug?
Well, I found an old rugby-type shirt in my closet.
Okay.
You know, tucked back in the corner, and I put it on. It's probably 25 years old, so I'm just thrilled. You think I'm dapper?
Well, yeah, I think so. I don't know what the word means, but it seems like it would apply here.
Well, I'm thinking maybe it was just because of the new football coach.
Oh,
and maybe that was it. You're an alumni, right?
Oh, at Michigan, that's right.
Yeah, you're a Michigan alum. So, I mean, I think thanks to you, you're getting Jim Harbaugh to coach your football team.
Yeah, I don't know whether to feel proud or embarrassed. I mean, I'm proud that Jim Harbaugh has come back, so to speak.
He was he was a quarterback there, wasn't he?
Coaching football.
True. That's true.
Did $64 million?
Whoa, hey.
Wow. Well, it's hard to tell because it said, you know, a base of $5 million a year plus incentives, and it's hard to know what that means.
Yeah, but
just to let you know why I think they paid that much money, it's because I gave up my season tickets last year.
Really?
We got to do something about this.
This product isn't worth it anymore, and I think a lot of people had that same sentiment, and so they figured to drive back up the demand. We got to spend whatever it takes to get things going here again, and it'll probably work.
Well, Doug, not only an alumni of the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, but he's also the senior teaching fellow and executive director at Preserving Bible Times there in Columbia, Maryland. And you've been around for, what, 15 years thereabouts as Preserving Bible Times now?
Yes, go back to the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So we're about to enter our 15th year.
Mm-hmm. And Doug speaks all over the country at churches, and he spent lots of time in the Hoosegow talking to those folks, too. You're well-known in the Kansas prison system in particular, aren't you?
I am. That just seems to be how my Yellow Brick Road worked itself out. But I'm going to be back in the Kansas prisons the third week in January for three more nights of teaching.
They want him back. They want him back. They've given him a key. He can come and go as he pleases, and that's got to be encouraging.
But it's also one of the finest audiences you could ever hope to teach.
You've related that to us, that they're particularly receptive and enthusiastic. But there's probably not a lot of competition for their thoughts and their minds. I imagine.
Actually, you'd be surprised at how many people want to get in on the prison teaching action. The biggest concern that chaplains and wardens have is, who are these people coming in that want to teach? Because there's a lot of weird stuff out there. Mm-hmm. And prisoners are particularly vulnerable to weird stuff.
Mm-hmm. I would guess.
One of the things that I've observed is a lot of them come to Christ in prison. And so they're zealous, they're energized, and a number of them have a lot of time on their hands, so they can study 4 and 5 hours a day if they care to. And without direction, without guidance, of which there is not a lot, they can easily go off into tangents. Mm-hmm. And numerology, end times, all sorts of symbolisms and what have you. And one of the reasons I like to go in there is to get them focused back on the Jesus Christ. And discover the real Jesus. Spend 3 or 4 years studying him, and then we'll worry about some of these other issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, so but, Doug's
it's exciting to go back in.
And just before we went on the air, we were kind of recapping what we're going to talk about today, and I fell into the trap of saying three wise men. It just comes out automatically. Three wise men. But Doug, we don't really know how many there were, do we?
Well, speaking of falling into the trap, you know, David sees that about every other week. So, you know, he's familiar with that phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you did fall into the trap, because it sets the stage nicely. Where did this notion of three wise men come from?
Well, it's got to be
not in the text.
It's got to be the gifts. There are three gifts, and so we automatically pair a gift with a wise man, and we come up with three.
And that's how it happens. Mm. But does that make it true? No.
No.
And if we've overlooked a very obvious fact in the most well-known story of all, the birth of Jesus, what might that say about how we've overlooked some of the other facts as regards the passages that we think we're familiar with?
Mm-hmm. Well, we're learning from you every week that without the context, whether you, I don't know if overlooking it is the right way, it is, but you're not aware of much of the meaning that is already there, that's there naturally, that if we understood the context and the historic times and were able to read that text the way its intended audience would be, that we would have a much greater understanding, much broader understanding of what's written there.
Well, it also points out how vulnerable we are to tradition. You know, just because somebody writes a Christmas hymn, "We Three Kings of Orient Are," we therefore make that a biblical fact. And it becomes so entrenched in tradition that if you want to suggest to people there really weren't three wise men, they think you're dealing in heresy. One of the things that...
Well, tradition can trump history, can it, in the popular
mindset?
Well,
exactly. Yeah. And you find that time and time again on the teaching weekends that I'm a part of, is that tradition does have a stronger grip on us than the biblical truth.
And we don't know that they were kings. And I don't think we're quite sure what wise men are, whether they were scholars, they were astrologists, they were of the priestly caste from wherever they came. I don't know.
Well, let's take the word astrologers, or we could take the word magi, which many have taken to mean magicians, okay? Mm-hmm. Could that even possibly be true?
Magicians. Well, I don't know what a magician would be in those days. Here, it's showbiz. Back then, it might have been a lot more serious. I understand that the word magi is a plural. It comes from magus. It's or magus, perhaps, is the way it's pronounced. And but I've forgotten what it means. It does not mean royalty. What does the word magi or magus mean?
Well, let me read from Jeremiah chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. "You people of Israel, listen to what the Lord has to say to you." Verse 2. "The Lord says, do not start following pagan religious practices. Do not be in awe of signs that occur in the sky, even though the nations hold them in awe." Okay? There, a Jewish person in the Old Testament is forbidden to engage in astrology, zodiacs, that sort of Capricorn, you know, all kind of thing. So they really can't be astrologers or magicians. I would say by Jewish definition. Now, let's back this train up just a little bit further. What's the nationality of these three wise men?
Well, they talk about coming from the East. That would tend to make them from Mesopotamia, perhaps. Babylon, perhaps. It could be from the Arabian Peninsula there, off to the east of the Jordan, with the huge desert area. And I know there's tradition in northern Iraq and Iran for these people to have come back afterwards and begun churches there. But to me, that just smacks of church tradition, not necessarily history. You know, that's the kind of the accreted belief of centuries of people, that all that church was started by one of the wise men who went to Bethlehem. I'm just looking at the Wikipedia page, and magi, or is the plural of magus, which I guess is magus or magos, and it refers to a follower of Zoroastrianism, or the person of Zoroaster, which was a religion in the Babylon area, and it was heavily dependent upon the moon and the sun and the stars and knowing those cycles, and it probably comes close to what we would call astrology.
Yeah, which is forbidden for a Jew.
Yeah.
Let's reflect for a moment. When the wise men whatever number they were, show up at Herod's palace in Jerusalem, what question do they ask Herod?
Well, I'm thinking of the question that he asked them. Now, what did he? Oh, they wanted to know where the Christ child was.
And the phraseology and specifics is, where is the King of the Jews?
Mm-hmm.
Now, who but Jews would be interested in knowing about the King of the Jews?
Well, I know that, again, just from my own reading here recently, because I've been looking at this, there were other religions that expected a Messiah. And they were looking for signs in the heavens of such occurring. And they could well have been Zoroastrianism, because that expected a Messiah. They believed in one God, one supreme God, who was totally good, that there was no evil in him, and that somehow there would be a resurrection and a redemption of all people. And that would come at the hands of a Messiah. So that was the Zoroastrian belief. And so they were looking for that to happen. And like the Jews, they may well have sensed that the time was near. You've talked to us about this 70-year cycle. The Jews were kind of in an expectant mood, anticipating the near arrival of their Messiah. I'm thinking Babylon, too, because the Jews had been captive there for a long time. And the Jewish culture had really gained a foothold there. I think the Jews fared quite well. There was a lot of Jewish writing and research and history recorded in Babylon. And some of the Jewish beliefs may have rubbed off on the Babylonian culture. What do you think of that?
I think Babylon is key to this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a map, Babylon is due east of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They came from the east. Now, I doubt that they came due east. There's too much deserts to deal with there. Mm-hmm. But they may well have taken the semicircular fertile crescent route, as Abraham did, Abram, when he left that Mesopotamian area to come to the Promised Land, which will also explain why it was a very, very long trip. There's a reason that Herod decreed all newborn sons, boys, 2 years and younger, because probably these wise men got to the scene 18 months after the birth of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long journey. So I would strongly suspect they're Jews. Only Jews would know that there is a coming King of the Jews, not other pagan religions.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing we need to appreciate is, in Babylon, observant Judaism continued in full flower. And therefore, they were doing all the major festivals yearly. And that meant they were scrupulous about their behavior. That meant they were scrupulous about the dates of all the major festivals, to do them exactly when God wanted them to unfold, both the beginning and the end. And the only way to do that is, because we've got two calendars at work here, lunar and solar, is they were astronomers, not astrologers, constantly studying the stars to determine when this year should our festivals start and stop, so that we always honor God's requirement to be precise in when they start and stop.
So you're saying their studies then would relate not so much to faith or superstition or seeing phenomena in the sky that they would interpret as some sort of supernatural intervention, but rather looking at celestial events in order to organize their calendar.
Exactly.
Ah.
As they have been doing for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now I want to read something else. From Numbers. Numbers 24:17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not close at hand. A star will march forth out of Jacob, and a scepter will rise out of Israel. He will crush the skulls of Moab and the heads of all the sons of Seth. the rabbis have come to conclude that this is messianic. Okay? Hmm. A star will come forth out of Jacob. So they have been looking for that star for a very long time.
Hmm.
And one year, as they're studying the stars, yet another week, yet another year to determine when the major festivals should start and stop this particular year, they see a new star, presumably a very bright star that they have never seen before. They remember this verse and they link it to the advent of Messiah, the King of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the only reasonable explanation that we can come up with that is contextually sound, is scripturally sound, and culturally sound.
Now, what do you know about the word star in Hebrew? Can it, you know, we use movie star, or it kind of means celebrity for us. And then there's of course the celestial star, the twinkling thing in the sky. Can that word apply to both in the Hebrew culture as well?
I have not researched the word star in Hebrew. So
I mean, so I'm wondering if in numbers they equate star with Messiah, if they're thinking celestial star simply marking the time of the Messiah, or if the Messiah is the star, because, you know, we often refer to Jesus, to Christ, as the bright and morning star as well.
Well, I think contextually we have to conclude it's something glowing in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the understanding of that word.
Well, why would there be a star in Jacob?
Has been, because that's what they're mm-hmm. looking for, and that's what they now will follow.
But it says a star will come out of Jacob. How does that relate to Jacob's offspring? You know, does it refer to the nation of Israel? Then a star will come out of the nation of Israel.
Once again, the context: Father Jacob, Abraham, Isaac, mm-hmm. and Jacob. Yeah. Yes, I think we're talking about a seed here.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
So anyway, they do bring three gifts, right?
Mm-hmm.
What are the three gifts?
Well, there's gold, and there's frankincense, and there's myrrh.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, let's start with gold. What's the symbolism usually associated with gold?
Kingship, royalty.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And can you foresee a very functional use for this gold as you look forward in the biblical story?
No.
Well, they're going to be leaving the Bethlehem area here mm-hmm. and heading to Egypt, right?
Well, that happened, yeah.
So they got to have some means to support them for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. We're not quite sure how long.
Mm-hmm.
Gold serves a very useful purpose. It may be the currency that supports them in, let's call it, exile in Egypt.
Are you suggesting that's why gold was included?
I wouldn't be surprised as to why it wasn't mm-hmm. concluded. Very practical use.
So we're suggesting that these people, these Zoroastrians or the wise men or the Magi, had some sense of what was going to happen afterwards as well.
No, not at all. But the Holy Spirit did.
Ah, okay.
And he can certainly orchestrate these events. Mm-hmm. And again, we're in the Near East. And that means you always bring a gift when you visit someone.
Mm.
And if your notion is that you're going to be visiting a new king, you give a lot of thought to which gifts you're going to bring.
Mm-hmm.
And what fascinates me here is in the midst of their thinking through what are appropriate gifts for this king newborn that we're going to visit, the Holy Spirit is at work orchestrating the three gifts that they decide to bring. One of which is gold, which certainly symbolizes kingship, but also has a very practical use here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a source of wealth, money, that they can use to live in exile until it's safe again to return. But that's not all the wise men brought, right? Gold.
And frankincense and myrrh. Now, frankincense comes from a plant. Is it an incense, something they burn in incense? Because I have this...
It is. There are four elements, four components that make up the mix of what's burned for the incense offering in the temple in Jerusalem, the third offering at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the one that Zechariah was a part of. Mm-hmm. And Lavona is one of the frankincense that is part of that compound.
So Lavona is a kind of frankincense.
It is.
Okay.
And what's characteristic about Lavona is when it's put on hot coals, when it's burned, it creates a lovely white ascending smoke. And it has come, that rising ascendant smoke has come to indicate the rising prayers of the people up to the heavens, mm-hmm. in the symbolism of worship in the temple. And might this Lavona frankincense be already signifying an upcoming sacrifice that will ascend to the heavens and be pleasing to his Father?
Mm-hmm.
Lavona.
Is it in and of itself valuable? Frankincense, expensive?
You know, I haven't, there are a number of frankincenses. It's mm-hmm. a family, mm-hmm. and I was only making reference to Lavona,
okay.
the one that's actually used in the temple mm-hmm. incense well, offering.
That would tie
I don't
in
personally know if Lavona is expensive, mm-hmm. rare, hard to obtain, hard to purify, et cetera, et cetera. It's an interesting thought.
Symbolism is fascinating, though. And if the Holy Spirit's at work, then you got to allow for that dimension of application in the story.
And so, you know, with Lavona, Passover, the Passover sacrifice of the Paschal Lamb may already be captured in the symbolism of frankincense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's myrrh.
Mm-hmm.
Myrrh is really fascinating. By way of analogy, we're familiar with how maple syrup is obtained from maple trees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to sort of cut it and get into the tree a little bit so the sap can start to run. Myrrh is an aromatic resin of a small family, a family of small thorny trees which grow in a dark and stony soil. Think thorny crown of thorns. And the way myrrh is obtained is that a tree is wounded through its bark and into the sapwood, and then the tree starts to bleed a resin, and that resin is the myrrh. So think of Jesus being on the cross, being invaded by a hammer that takes nails and drives him into his body, the spear that cuts his side and outflows the fluid. Some would see here that myrrh is very indicative of how Jesus was systematically defleshed, wounded, cut into mm-hmm. as part of the scourging process heading towards the cross.
In addition,
and the other thing we know about myrrh and mm-hmm. The Egyptians at this moment in time, and they will continue this practice for quite some time, use myrrh as part of the process of preparing the dead.
Mm-hmm.
So
now, I also understand that myrrh was a balm, a healing agent. It was used medicinally. And in fact, reference to the balm in Gilead is a reference to myrrh, because that's where one area where those trees proliferated. That is northeast of the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, they really grow in a very barren ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
Which is another whole layer of symbolism here. But I think what's fascinating about combining all this together is the symbolism of the three gifts and what they portend, what they suggest for the future for this newborn king, King of the Jews.
Do you think that the recipients of the gift, that is Joseph and Mary and the Christ child, or others that knew that those were the gifts, would have seen the same symbolism at that time? Or is this something that that we look back on and go, wow, you know, just it's what a tie-in that is. Would they have seen that?
You know, that's a good question. I think I'd want to ponder that one for a while.
I'm asking this because I'm wondering if they would have seen attached, that is, they would have seen and attached the same significance to those gifts that we now do.
If I had to guess, and that's all I can do, is for Mary, let's deal with her since we know she ponders. The significance of all three of those gifts might not have fully coalesced in her mind until perhaps Passion Week. I'm not sure the significance of the myrrh and the frankincense as deals with the cross would have been part of her thinking in the first early years of the life of Jesus.
But she well may have seen the frankincense or the Lavona as being something that the priests use in their sacrifices in cleansing the nation of Israel and their prayers. That part of the symbolism she may have seen. She may not have foreseen a crucifixion at that point. But I kind of think she would have understood. And Joseph, well, they're both I want to say they're Levites, but they're not Levites, are they? Joseph and Mary?
No, they're from the Davidic clan.
Okay, so they're from Judah, not Levites. So, but still, in that culture where you got right with God by making sacrifices at the temple, I suspect that the symbolism of frankincense and myrrh would have been on their minds. They would have.
Well, on frankincense, it certainly would have had a priestly connotation to it, and she may well have had that in her understanding even in these early days.
And of course, she had the message from the angel. She knew he was special.
So, some of the possibilities for the context of an unknown number of wise men who brought three gifts.
Now, there's something else I've come across here recently. In fact, it was just a couple days ago from the Christianity Today pages, and it had to do with archaeology. One of the, and I don't have it in front of me here now, one of the archaeologists working out there has found a coin recently that dates to the first century, and it pictures a ram moving. This is on the one face of the coin. It's a ram who's moving from left to right, but looking back over his shoulder at what appears to be a star on the edge of the coin. And the belief is, the interpreting the symbols here, is that the ram was somehow symbolic of the tribe of Judah or the land of Judah, and looking at a star. And so it led them to do some more research on the star. And one of the things they claim is that the Greek word for phrase for the star in the east may actually refer to a planet at the time it becomes a morning star. You know, when it's just at the right place on the horizon in the wee small hours of the morning. And we have morning stars, our Venus and Saturn and others. I don't know how that all works. But that the phrase didn't necessarily mean a glow in the eastern part of the sky, but it marked a time when a planet was in that part of its ascendancy where it was became what we would call a morning star. So that the phrase star in the east has double meaning, at least. Have you heard that at all?
I had not, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a double meaning to it. We do know whatever it was, it had significance to these wise men in Babylon, and it caused them to take this journey.
But it had significance to the timing of Jesus' birth, not so much the place, didn't it? Because that when Herod asked him, he asked, "When did you see the star?" Not "Where did you see the star?" He asked "When." That was what he needed to know, was the time of the birth of Jesus, was it not?
Yeah, it was, and part of the reason he killed all two-year-olds is because it would seem that these wise men got to Herod 18 months after the birth of Jesus, and so he had 6 months to it just to make sure that no one escapes his grasp here. And it raises some further questions. Mary and Joseph and Jesus are still in Bethlehem 18 months after his birth.
Mm-hmm. And of course,
who are they staying with?
Well, they're in a home, it says.
It is. It shifts from kataluma, mm-hmm. guest room, to house. Well, whose house?
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea, but it is fascinating. They just didn't get there at 10 o'clock the night before, give birth, and leave town. Yep. 2 days or
so
9 days later.
So if you have a nativity set that has three wise men there, you better pack them away because they weren't there. You'd want an authentic representation, wouldn't you know?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Well, I'm just thinking if you all those creche sets out there that show cows and donkeys and wise men as part of the ensemble, you need to pack some of those away. They weren't there.
Oh, yeah, and remove them along with the donkeys and the horses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the way, speaking of that, I spoke at a family clan get-together in early December on the real birth of Jesus, and we met at the matriarch's house. She was 90 years old, and as I was setting up to make this presentation to this family clan in their large extended family room on the back porch, I noticed the creche set in the dining room, and it was very unusual, so I walked up closer to it, and it was the most accurate creche set I have ever seen or yet seen, because, see if I can describe this here, there was a stony stair going up to a front door, which presumably would have been the house itself. And then there was a door which entered the basement, and that door was open, and it was lit inside, and there was Mary, Joseph, and the babe. And that's the closest thing I've seen to a creche set that actually had Jesus being born in the sub-basement of a home. I've asked them to find out where they bought it. They had bought it some 30 years earlier. I traced it down to a firm in Wisconsin who makes creche sets. It has an Italian name, escapes me at the moment. It was something like Panini. I called them up and said, can I get one of those creche sets? They said, oh, well, we discontinued that 15 years ago. But I just want to let you know, I literally have seen a creche set that comes reasonably close to the so-called guest room, kataluma, basement, small animal holding area, representation of the birth of Jesus, so unlike 87 million other creche sets that don't have that representation.
Well, it's nice to know somebody got it right.
Yeah, and then they discontinued it, because who'd be interested in that?
They had to sell the wise men as an add-on, maybe, that you could, you know.
Now, which is interesting, 15 years ago was when Preserving Bible Time started.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if they'd have held on a little bit longer, we could have built some demand for that creche set.
I think so. We're talking with Doug Greenwald, the Senior Teaching Fellow, and again, the Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Looking forward to your trip out here in March, Doug.
And as are we, to do both things, to teach not only making disciples Jesus' way, but speaking of Livona, to do a teaching weekend on the last 40 days of the life of Jesus, the greatest story never totally told.
And so it's going to be a special time here in East Dakota when Doug and his wife Nancy come and make that presentation. I think we're just excited about that. This will be his second trip to this area. He can visit you too, where you are. And if you want to set up such a visit to maybe your church, you might want to check out the ministry first at preservingbibletimes.org. It's a beautiful website, brand new website, gorgeous photos of Israel and within some of the inner pages, and on the Facebook page, you see a lot of pictures of Doug's recent trips to Italy as well, and what I've called his Pauline Studies tours. It's a magnificent website. You can link to it right from ours if you're listening on Broken Road Radio this morning, brokenroadradio.com. You find the link to Preserving Bible Times over on the right-hand side of the homepage. And also, the podcast tab at the top of the page, there's a complete archive of Doug's conversations with us over the past 3 years now. And you can learn a lot. Listen to one now and then. Download it. Listen at your convenience, or you can listen to it right on the website And I think you'd be very pleased with what you hear. And do visit that website, preservingbibletimes.org. Dave, any last thoughts before I push the button here? That sounds kind of ominous, doesn't it? Last thoughts before I push the button.
Last thoughts. I was looking at some of the specifics. So one of the three gifts, myrrh and frankincense. Frankincense is something that was common, you know, as long as 2,000 or 3,000 years before Christ. And it's also got a reference to Old French. And the Old French etymology says franc, F-R-A-N-C, new word, E-N-C-E-N-S. And it's, you know, it means very expensive incense. I found that interesting.
Yeah,
it doesn't say anything more about it, it just says that and then nothing else.
Yeah, it was a business. It was a profit-making enterprise, manufacturing mm-hmm. frankincense and myrrh, for that matter. And, you know, there's a hymn called There's a Balm in Gilead. And that refers to the myrrh that was grown there. So, mm-hmm. they were well known, and they were valuable spices and part of the priestly entourage. The procedures that they use. So people, I think, were generally familiar with them. Interesting.
Yeah, it says in the Wikipedia page also that frankincense had been traded on the Arabian Peninsula in North Africa for 5,000 years. Mm-hmm. And there is an ancient mural on one of the Egyptian temples depicts Queen Hatshepsut, who died 1500 BC. And it depicts sacks of frankincense traded from the land of Punt.
Oh.
I had no idea.
You had some relatives out that way, huh?
I could be descended from royalty.
Yeah.
Now we're talking.
Doug, thank you so much. Have a happy new year to you, okay?
Thanks, guys. Same to you.
The whole
shalom,
ministry.
Shalom.
And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.